interested in and reason rigorously about even more distant and locally invisible relationships than the formal relationship of marriage. Speciation, like marriage, is a concept anchored within a tight, formally definable system of thought. But unlike marriage, it has no conventional saliencies, weddings, rings, certificates, by which it can be observed. As we just saw, speciation is also a curiously long-distance phenomenon in both space and time. Species are fuzzy-edged collections over time, and we could only retrospectively and arbitrarily identify some individual organism in such a crowd as the prime mammal, so don't bother. We can see this feature of speciation in a better light by looking first at another instance of retrospective crowning, the conferring of the title of mitochondrial Eve, which is not arbitrary. Individual organisms have rather crisper boundaries and hence clearer identities than species. But even with them, there are plenty of fence-sitters. Let's take the most striking instance. Of the 10 trillion or so cells that are crowded together inside your clothes, 9 out of 10 are not human. Yes, symbiont visitors in thousands of species outnumber your host cells, the cells that descended from the zygote formed by your parents' union. There are not only bacteria, but also eukaryotes, both single-celled microbes and multicellular organisms, fungi, mites in your eyelashes and elsewhere, worms microscopic and bigger, and who knows what else. You are a walking ecosystem, and while some of the visitors are unwanted, the fungi that cause athlete's foot or the bacteria that lead to bad breath or crowd around any infection, others are so essential that if you succeeded in evicting all the trespassers, you would die. Since these symbiont cells are generally much smaller than your human cells, by weight you are mostly human. But their combined weight is not negligible either. Probably several pounds, and maybe as much as 10. Then there are the viruses in even greater numbers. Still, in spite of your porous boundaries, you, like other individual organisms, are readily distinguished from the others. And sometimes we can single out a specific individual organism for a specific role in evolutionary history. Mitochondrial Eve is one of the most famous. Mitochondrial Eve is the woman who is the most recent direct ancestor, in the female line, of every human being alive today. We all have mitochondria in our cells, and they are passed to us through the maternal line alone. So all the mitochondria in all the cells in all the people alive today are direct descendants of the mitochondria in the cells of a particular woman named Mitochondrial Eve by Rebecca Kahn, Mark Stoneking, and Alan Wilson, 1987. Mitochondria are tiny organelles in our cells that play a central role in metabolism, capturing energy from food to use in all the body's projects. And mitochondria have their own DNA, a telling trace of their symbiotic origin several billion years ago. By analyzing the patterns in the mitochondrial DNA of the different people alive today, scientists have been able to deduce roughly how recently mitochondrial Eve lived, and even where she lived. Early calculations suggested that mitochondrial Eve lived in Africa about 300,000 years ago, but that number has been refined more recently. She lived, in Africa almost certainly, only 200,000 years ago. Deducing where and when is a far trickier task than deducing that there was a mitochondrial Eve, something no biologist doubts. Consider a few of the things we already know about mitochondrial Eve, setting aside the controversies. We know that she had at least two daughters who had surviving daughters. If she had just one daughter, her daughter would wear the crown of mitochondrial Eve. To distinguish her title from her proper name, let's call her Amy. Amy bears the title of mitochondrial Eve. That is, she just happens to have been the maternal founder of today's line of people. It is important to remind ourselves that in all other regards, there was probably nothing remarkable or special about mitochondrial Eve. She was certainly not the first woman, nor the founder of the species Homo sapiens. Many earlier women were unquestionably of our species, but none of them, as it happens, was the most recent source of all the mitochondria in all the people living today. It is also true that although mitochondrial Eve had daughters and granddaughters, she was probably not noticeably stronger, faster, more beautiful, or more fecund than the other women of her day. To bring out just how unspecial mitochondrial Eve, that is, Amy, probably was, suppose that tomorrow, thousands of generations later, a virulent new disease were to spread around the Earth, wiping out 99% of the human race in a few years. The survivors, fortunate to have some innate resistance to the disease virus, would probably be quite closely related. Their closest common direct female ancestor, call her Betty, would be some woman who lived hundreds or thousands of generations later than Amy, and the crown of mitochondrial Eve would pass to her retroactively. She may have been the source of the mutation that centuries later became a species saver, but it probably didn't do her any good, since the virus against which it triumphs probably didn't exist in its virulent form then. The point is that mitochondrial Eve can only be retrospectively crowned. This historically pivotal role is determined not just by the accidents of Amy's own time, but by the accidents of later times as well. Talk about massive contingency. If Amy's uncle hadn't saved her from drowning when she was 3, none of us, with our particular mitochondrial DNA, thanks ultimately to Amy, would ever have existed. If all of Amy's granddaughters had starved to death in infancy, as so many infants did in those days, the same oblivion would be ours. The same logical argument establishes that there is, must be, an Adam as well, the closest direct male ancestor of every man and boy alive today. We can call him Y-chromosome Adam, since all our Y-chromosomes pass down through the paternal line just the way our mitochondria pass through the maternal line. Was Y-chromosome Adam the husband or lover of mitochondrial Eve? Not a chance. Paternity being a much less time and energy-consuming business than maternity, what is logically possible is that Y-chromosome Adam lived very recently and was very, very busy in the bedroom, leaving Errol Flynn in his, dust. If the oldest living man today is, say, 110 years old, it is logically possible that Y-chromosome Adam was his father, an early 20th century Don Juan, who is also the father or grandfather or great-grandfather and so on of all the younger living males. We males make billions of sperm, after all, hundreds of millions in each ejaculation. So it wouldn't take Y-chromosome Adam more than a week to make enough sperm to father the whole human race, in principle. But by counting all the genetic differences in men's Y-chromosomes around the world and calculating how long it would take for that much mutation to accumulate, we can estimate the actual date for Y-chromosome Adam as somewhat less than 100,000 years ago. And again, if a plague struck down half, say, the male population, in all likelihood the crown of Y-chromosome Adam would pass to a much more recent progenitor. A curious fact about every individual organism, you or me or your dog or your geranium, for instance, is that it is a potential founder of a new species, the first of a long line of whatchamacallits, but it will be hundreds or thousands of generations before whatchamacallits stand out from the crowd enough to be recognized as a species. So the coronation would have to occur long after you or I or your dog or your geranium had returned to dust. Your parents could thus turn out to be the most recent common ancestors of all the members of two humanoid species. But don't hold your breath. Chihuahuas and Great Danes are members of the same species, Canis familiaris. But if civilization collapses and their respective offspring go feral, they could more readily achieve the breakaway of speciation than, say, beagles and basset hounds, since without human help, fertilization of Chihuahuas by Great Danes, or vice versa, is unlikely. In all likelihood, however, both lineages would go extinct, as have most lineages over the eons before that happened. It is estimated that well over 99% of all the organisms that have ever lived have died without having had offspring. And yet, here you are, of all your billions of ancestors over the years, from single cells to worms to fish to reptiles to mammals to primates, not a single one of them died childless. How lucky you are! Of course, every blade of grass has an equally long and proud heritage, and every mosquito and every elephant and every daisy. 46. Cycles. Everybody knows about the familiar large-scale cycles of nature. Day follows night follows day, summer, fall, winter, spring, summer, fall, winter, spring, the water cycle of evaporation and precipitation that refills our lakes, scours our rivers, and restores the water supply of every living thing on the planet. But not everybody appreciates how cycles, at every spatial and temporal scale from the atomic to the astronomic, are quite literally the hidden spinning motors that power all the wonderful phenomena of nature. Nicholas Otto built and sold the first internal combustion gasoline engine in 1861, and Rudolf Diesel built his engine in 1897, two brilliant inventions that changed the world. Each exploits a cycle, the four-stroke Otto cycle and the two-stroke Diesel cycle, that accomplishes some work and then restores the system to its original position so that it is ready to accomplish more work. The details of these cycles are ingenious, and they have been discovered and optimized by an R&D cycle of invention that is several centuries old. An even more elegant, micro-miniaturized engine is the Krebs cycle, which was discovered in 1937 by Hans Krebs, but invented over millions of years of evolution at the dawn of life. It is the eight-stroke chemical reaction that turns fuel, food, into energy in the process of metabolism that is essential to all life, from bacteria to redwood trees. Biochemical cycles, like the Krebs cycle, are responsible for all the motion, growth, self-repair, and reproduction in the living world. Wheels within wheels within wheels, a clockwork with trillions of moving parts, and each clock needing to be rewound, restored to step one, so that it can do its duty again. All of these cycles have been optimized by the grand Darwinian cycle of reproduction, generation after generation, picking up fortuitous improvements over the eons. At a completely different scale, our ancestors discovered the efficacy of cycles in one of the great advances of human prehistory, the role of repetition in manufacture. Take a stick and rub it with a stone, and almost nothing happens. A few scratches are the only visible sign of change. Bring the stick back to the starting point and do it again. Still, you have almost nothing to show for your efforts. Rub it 100 times and there is still hardly anything to see. But rub it just so for a few thousand times and you can turn it into an uncannily straight arrow shaft. By the accumulation of imperceptible increments, the cyclical process creates something altogether new. The combination of foresight and self-control required for such projects was itself a novelty, a vast improvement over the repetitive but largely instinctual and mindless building and shaping processes of other animals. And that novelty was itself a product of the Darwinian cycle, enhanced eventually by the swifter cycle of cultural evolution, in which the reproduction of the technique wasn't passed on to offspring through the genes, but transmitted among non-kin who picked up the trick of imitation. The first ancestor who polished a stone into a handsomely symmetrical hand axe must have looked pretty stupid in the process. There he sat, rubbing away for hours on end, to no apparent effect. But hidden in the interstices of all the mindless repetition was a process of gradual refinement that was well nigh invisible to a naked eye, designed by evolution to detect changes occurring at a much faster tempo. The same appearance of futility has occasionally misled sophisticated biologists. In his elegant book, Wetware, the molecular and cell biologist Dennis Bray, 2009, describes cycles in the nervous system. In a typical signaling pathway, proteins are continually being modified and demodified. Kinases and phosphates work ceaselessly like ants in a nest, adding phosphate groups to proteins and removing them again. It seems a pointless exercise, especially when you consider that each cycle of addition and removal costs the cell one molecule of ATP, one unit of precious energy. Indeed, cyclic reactions of this kind were initially labeled futile, but the adjective is misleading. The addition of phosphate groups to proteins is the single most common reaction in cells and underpins a large proportion of the computations they perform. Far from being futile, this cyclic reaction provides the cell with an essential resource, a flexible and rapidly tunable device. Page 75. The word computations is aptly chosen. Computer programmers have been exploring the space of possible computations for less than a century, but their harvest of invention and discovery so far includes millions of loops within loops within loops. It turns out that all the magic of cognition depends, just as life itself does, on cycles within cycles of recurrent, re-entrant, reflexive information transformation processes, ranging from the nanoscale biochemical cycles within each neuron, through the generate and test cycles of predictive coding in the perceptual systems. See Clark 2013 for a brilliant survey, to the whole brain sleep cycle, large-scale waves of cerebral activity and recovery that are revealed by EEG recordings. The secret ingredient of improvement everywhere in life is always the same. Practice, practice, practice. It is useful to remember that Darwinian evolution is just one kind of accumulative, refining cycle. There are plenty of others. The problem of the origin of life can be made to look insoluble, irreducibly complex, Behe 1996, if one argues, as intelligent design advocates have done, that since evolution by natural selection depends on reproduction, there cannot be a Darwinian solution to the problem of how the first living, reproducing thing came to exist. It was surely breathtakingly complicated, beautifully designed. It must have been a miracle. If we lapse into thinking of the prebiotic, pre-reproductive world as a sort of featureless chaos of chemicals, like the scattered parts of the notorious jetliner assembled by a windstorm that creationists invite us to imagine, the problem does look daunting and worse. But if we remind ourselves that the key process in evolution is cyclical repetition, of which genetic replication is just one highly refined and optimized instance, we can begin to see our way to turning the mystery into a puzzle. How did all those seasonal cycles, water cycles, geological cycles, and chemical cycles, spinning for millions of years, gradually accumulate the preconditions for inaugurating the biological cycles? Probably the first 1,000 tries were futile, near misses. But as the wonderfully sensual song by George Gershwin and Buddy De Silva reminds us, see what happens if you do it again and again and again. A good rule of thumb, then, when confronting the apparent magic of the world of life and mind, is to look for the cycles that are doing all the hard work. 47. What does the frog's eye tell the frog's brain? One of the early classics of cognitive science is the famous paper, What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain, by J.Y. Letvin and colleagues, 1959. It showed that the frog's visual system is sensitive to small, moving, dark spots on the retina, tiny shadows cast in almost all natural circumstances by flies flying in the vicinity. This fly detector mechanism is appropriately wired to the hair trigger in the frog's tongue, which handily explains how frogs feed themselves in a cruel world and thereby help propagate their kind. Now, what does the frog's eye tell the frog's brain? That there is a fly out there, or that there is a fly or a slug? A fake fly of one sort or another. Or a thing of kind K? Whatever kind of thing reliably triggers this visual gadget. Recall the two-bitzer. Darwinian meaning theorists, such as Ruth Millikan, David Israel, and I, have discussed this very case. And the arch-critic of evolutionary theory, Jerry Fodor, has pounced on it to show what is wrong, by his lights, with any evolutionary account of such meanings. They are too indeterminate. They fail to distinguish, as they ought, between such frog-eye reports as fly here now and fly or small dark projectile here now, and so forth. But this is false. We can use the frog's environment of selection, to the extent that we can determine what it has been, to distinguish between the various candidates. To do this, we use exactly the same considerations we used to settle the questions about the meaning of the state in the two-bitzer, and to the extent that there is nothing in the selective environment that uniquely singles out a particular class of occasions, there is also no fact of the matter about what the frog's eye report really means. This can be brought home vividly by sending the frog to Panama, or more precisely, sending the frog to a novel selective environment. Suppose scientists gather up a small population of frogs from some fly-grabbing species on the brink of extinction and put them under protective custody in a new environment, a special frog zoo in which there are no flies, but rather zookeepers who periodically arrange to launch little food pellets past the frogs in their care. To the keeper's delight, the system works. The frogs thrive by zapping their tongues for these pellets, and after a while, there's a crowd of descendant frogs who have never seen a fly, only pellets. What do their eyes tell their brains? If you insist on saying the meaning hasn't changed, you're in a bind. The case of the frogs is simply an artificially clear instance of what happens in natural selection all the time. Exaptation, the reuse of an existing structure for a new function. As Darwin was careful to remind us, the reuse of machinery for new purposes is one of the secrets of Mother Nature's success. We can drive home the point to anyone who wishes some further persuasion by supposing that not all the captive frogs do equally well. Variation in pellet detecting prowess in their visual systems causes some to eat less heartily than others, and then to leave less progeny as a result. In short order, there will have been undeniable selection for pellet detection, though it would be a mistake to ask exactly when enough of this has occurred for it to count. Don't listen for a bell to ring indicating that what the frog's eye is saying has just now been revised. There was no prime mammal, and there is no prime pellet detection. Unless there were meaningless or indeterminate variation in the triggering conditions of the various frogs' eyes, there could be no raw material, blind variation, for selection for a new purpose to act upon. The indeterminacy that Fodor and others see as a flaw in Darwinian accounts of the evolution of meaning is actually a precondition for any such evolution. The idea that there must be something determinate that the frog's eye really means, some possibly unknowable proposition in froggish that expresses exactly what the frog's eye is telling the frog's brain, is just essentialism applied to meaning, or function. Meaning, like function, on which it so directly depends, is not something determinate at its birth. It arises not by saltation, huge leaps in design space, or special creation, but by a typically gradual shift of circumstances. 48. Leaping through space in the Library of Babel. In 1988, Otto Neugebauer, the great historian of astronomy, was sent a photograph of a fragment of Greek papyrus that had a few numbers written in a column on it. The sender, a classicist, had no clue about the meaning of this bit of papyrus and wondered if Neugebauer had any ideas. The 89-year-old scholar recomputed the line-to-line differences of the numbers, found their maximum and minimum limits, and determined that this papyrus had to be a translation of part of column G of a Babylonian cuneiform tablet, on which was written a Babylonian System B lunar ephemeris. An ephemeris is a tabular system for computing the location of a heavenly body for every time in a particular period. How could Neugebauer make this Sherlock Holmesian deduction? Elementary. He recognized that what was written in Greek, a sequence of sexagesimal, not decimal, numbers, was part, column G, of a highly accurate calculation of the moon's location that had been worked out by the Babylonians. There are lots of different ways of calculating an ephemeris, and Neugebauer knew that anyone working out their own ephemeris independently, using their own system, would not have come up with exactly the same numbers, although they might have been close. The Babylonian system B was excellent, so the design had been gratefully conserved, in translation, with all its fine-grained particularities. Neugebauer, 1989. Neugebauer was a great scholar, but you can probably execute a parallel feat of deduction following in his footsteps. Suppose you were sent a photocopy of the following text and asked the same question. Freunde Römer Mitbürger, gebt mir Gehör. Ich komme Caesar als Leiche zu bestatten, nicht ihn zu loben. What does it mean? Where might this be from? Did you get it? Impressive stunt. Neugebauer may have his Babylonian column G, but you quickly determined, didn't you, that this fragment must be part of a German translation of lines from an Elizabethan tragedy, Act 3, Scene 2, lines 79 to 80, to be exact. Once you think about it, you realize that it could hardly be anything else. The odds against this particular sequence of German letters getting strung together under any other circumstances are vast. The R&D that went into creating that sequence is too specific to be duplicated by chance. Why? What is the particularity that marks such a string of symbols? Nicholas Humphrey, 1987, makes the question vivid by posing a more drastic version. If you were forced to consign to oblivion one of the following masterpieces, which would you choose? Newton's Principia? Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? Mozart's Don Giovanni? Or Eiffel's Tower? If the choice were forced, Humphrey answers, I have little doubt which it should be. The Principia would have to go. How so? Because of all those works, Newton's was the only one that was not irreplaceable. Quite simply, if Newton had not written it, then someone else would, probably within the space of a few years. The Principia was a glorious monument to human intellect. The Eiffel Tower was a relatively minor feat of romantic engineering, yet the fact is that while Eiffel did it his way, Newton merely did it God's way. 49. Who is the author of Spamlet? Suppose Dr. Frankenstein designs and constructs a monster, Spakeshear, which thereupon sits up and writes out a play, Spamlet. Who is the author of Spamlet? First, let's take note of what I claim to be irrelevant in this intuition pump. I haven't said whether Spakeshear is a robot constructed out of metal and silicon chips, or, like the original Frankenstein's monster, constructed out of human tissues, or nano-engineered out of cells or proteins or amino acids or carbon atoms. As long as Dr. Frankenstein carried out the design work and the construction, it makes no difference to the example what the materials are. It might well turn out that the only way to build a robot small enough and fast enough and energy efficient enough to sit on a stool and type out a play is to construct it from artificial cells filled with beautifully crafted motor proteins and other carbon-based nanorobots. That is an interesting technical and scientific issue, but not of concern here. For exactly the same reason, if Spakeshear is a metal and silicon robot, it may be larger than a galaxy if that's what it takes to get the requisite complication into its program. And we may have to repeal the speed limit for light so that we can imagine it taking place in a human length of time. These technical constraints are commonly declared to be off-limits in such intuition pumps. And this time we may go along with the gag since nothing will hinge on it. Turn the knobs and see if this is so. If Dr. Frankenstein chooses to make his artificial intelligence, AI robot, out of proteins and the like, that's his business. If his robot is cross-fertile with normal human beings and hence capable of creating what is arguably a new species by giving birth to a child, that is fascinating. But what we will be concerned with is Spakeshear's purported brainchild, Spamlet. Back to our question. Who is the author of Spamlet? In order to get a grip on this question, we have to look inside and see what happens in Spakeshear. At one extreme, we find inside a file, if Spakeshear is a robot with a computer memory, or a basically memorized version of Spamlet, all loaded and ready to run. In such an extreme case, Dr. Frankenstein is surely the author of Spamlet, using his intermediate creation, Spakeshear, as a mere storage and delivery device, a particularly fancy word processor. All the R&D work was done earlier and copied to Spakeshear by one means or another. We can visualize this more clearly by imagining Spamlet and its galaxy of near neighbors in the Library of Babel. How did Spamlet get there? What was the trajectory of R&D that created it? If we find that the whole journey was already completed by the time Spakeshear's memory was constructed and filled with information, we know that Spakeshear played no role at all in the search. Working backward, if we find that Spakeshear's only role was running the stored text through a spell checker before using it to guide its typing motions, we will be unimpressed by claims of Spakeshearian authorship. This is a measurable, but vanishing part of the total R&D. There is a sizable galaxy of near-twin texts of Spamlet. Roughly 100 million different minor mutants have but a single uncorrected typo in them. And if we expand our horizon to include one typo per page, we have begun to enter the land of vast numbers of variations on the theme. Working back a little further, once we graduate from typos to thinkos, those arguably mistaken or suboptimally chosen words, we have begun to enter the land of serious authorship, as contrasted with mere copy editing. The relative triviality of copy editing, and yet its unignorable importance in shaping the final product, get well represented in design space, where every little bit of lifting counts for something, and sometimes a little bit of lifting moves you onto a whole new trajectory. As usual, we may quote Ludwig Mies van der Rohe at this juncture. God is in the details. Now let's turn the knobs on our intuition pump and look at the other extreme, in which Dr. Frankenstein leaves most of the work to Spakeshear. The most realistic scenario would surely be that Dr. Frankenstein equipped Spakeshear with a virtual past, a lifetime stock of pseudo-memories of experiences on which to draw while responding to its Frankenstein-installed obsessive desire to write a play. Among those pseudo-memories, we may suppose, are many evenings at the theater or reading books, but also some unrequited loves, some shockingly close calls, some shameful betrayals, and the like. Now, what happens? Perhaps some scrap of a human interest story on the network news will be the catalyst that spurs Spakeshear into a frenzy of generate and test, ransacking its memory for useful tidbits and themes, transforming what it finds, jiggling the pieces into temporary, hopeful structures that compete for completion, most of them dismantled by the corrosive processes of criticism that nevertheless expose useful bits now and then, and so forth. All of this multi-leveled search would be somewhat guided by multi-level, internally generated evaluations, including evaluation of the evaluation of the evaluation functions as a response to evaluation of the products of the ongoing searches. Cycles within cycles within cycles. Now, if the amazing Dr. Frankenstein had actually anticipated all this activity down to its finest grain at the most turbulent and chaotic level, and had hand-designed Spakeshear's virtual past and all its search machinery to yield just this product, Spamlet, then Dr. Frankenstein would be, once again, the author of Spamlet. But also, in a word, God. Such vast foreknowledge would be simply miraculous. Restoring a smidgen of realism to our fantasy, we can set the knobs at a less extreme position and assume that Dr. Frankenstein was unable to foresee all this in detail, but rather delegated to Spakeshear most of the hard work of completing the trajectory in design space to one literary work or another, something to be determined by later R&D occurring within Spakeshear itself. We have now arrived, by this simple turn of the knob, in the neighborhood of reality itself. For we already have actual examples of impressive artificial authors that vastly outstrip the foresight of their own creators. Nobody has yet created an artificial playwright worth serious attention, but both an artificial chess player, IBM's Deep Blue, and an artificial composer, David Cope's EMI, have achieved results that are, in some respects, equal to the best that human creative genius can produce. Who beat Garry Kasparov, the reigning world chess champion? Not Murray Campbell, or any members of his IBM team. Deep Blue beat Kasparov. Deep Blue designs better chess games than any of them can design. None of them can author a winning game against Kasparov. Deep Blue can. Yes, but. Yes, but. You may be tempted to insist at this point that when Deep Blue beats Kasparov at chess, its brute force search methods are entirely unlike the exploratory processes that Kasparov uses when he conjures up his chess moves. But that is simply not so. Or at least, it is not so in the only way that could make a difference to the context of this discussion of the Darwinian perspective on creativity. Kasparov's brain is made of organic materials and has an architecture importantly unlike that of Deep Blue. But it is still, so far as we know, a massively parallel search engine that has built up, over time, an outstanding array of heuristic pruning techniques that keep it from wasting time on unlikely branches. There is no doubt that the investment in R&D has a different profile in the two cases. Kasparov has methods of extracting good design principles from past games so that he can recognize, and know enough to ignore, huge portions of the game space that Deep Blue must still patiently canvas seriatim. Kasparov's insight dramatically changes the shape of the search he engages in, but it does not constitute an entirely different means of creation. Whenever Deep Blue's exhaustive searches close off a type of avenue that has some algorithmic way of identifying as probably negligible, a difficult but not impossible task, it can reuse that R&D whenever it is appropriate, just as Kasparov does. Deep Blue's designers have done much of this analytical work and given it as an innate endowment to Deep Blue. But Kasparov has likewise benefited from the fruits of hundreds of thousands of person years of chess exploration transmitted to him by players, coaches, and books, and subsequently installed in the habits of his brain. It is interesting in this regard to contemplate a suggestion Bobby Fischer once made. He proposed to restore the game of chess to its intended rational purity by requiring that the major white pieces be randomly placed in the back row and the major black pieces be arranged in the same random order, mirror image, in the opposite back row at the start of each game, but always ensuring that each side has a white square and a black square bishop, and the king was between the rooks. This would instantly render the mountain of memorized openings almost entirely obsolete, for humans and machines alike, since only rarely would any of this lore come into play. One would be thrown back onto a reliance of fundamental principles. One would have to do more of the hard design work in real time, with the clock running. It is far from clear whether this change in rules would benefit human beings more than computers. It all depends on which type of chess player is relying most heavily on what is, in effect, rote memory. Reliance with minimal comprehension on the R&D of earlier explorers. The fact is that the search space for chess is too big for even Deep Blue to explore exhaustively in real time. So, like Kasparov, it prunes its search trees by taking calculated risks. And like Kasparov, it often gets these risks pre-calculated. Both presumably do massive amounts of brute force computation on their very different architectures. After all, what do neurons know about chess? Any work they do must be brute force work of one sort or another. It may seem that I am begging the question in favor of a computational AI approach by describing the work done by Kasparov's brain in this way. But the work has to be done somehow, and no other way of getting the work done has ever been articulated. It won't do to say that Kasparov uses insight or intuition, since that just means that Kasparov himself has no privileged access, no insight into how the good results come to him. So since nobody, least of all Kasparov, knows how Kasparov's brain does it, there is not yet any evidence to support the claim that Kasparov's means are entirely unlike the means exploited by Deep Blue. One should remember this when tempted to insist that, of course, Kasparov's methods are hugely different. What on earth could provoke one to go out on a limb like that? Wishful thinking? Fear? But that's just chess, you say, not art. Chess is trivial compared to art. Now that the world chess champion is a computer, this is where composer and computer hacker David Cope's Experiments in Musical Intelligence, or EMI for short, 2000-2001, come into play. Cope set out to create a mere efficiency enhancer, a composer's aid to help him over the blockades of composition any creator confronts, a high-tech extension of the traditional search vehicles, the piano, staff paper, the tape recorder, etc. As EMI grew in competence, it promoted itself into a whole composer, incorporating more and more of the generate and test process. When EMI is fed music by Bach, it responds by generating musical compositions in the style of Bach. When given Mozart or Schubert or Puccini or Scott Joplin, it readily analyzes their styles and then composes new music in those styles, better pastiches than Cope himself, or almost any human composer, can write. When fed music by two composers, EMI can promptly compose pieces that eerily unite their styles. And when fed, all at once, with no clearing of the palate, you might say, all these styles, it proceeds to write music based on the totality of its musical experience. The compositions that result can then also be fed back into it, over and over, along with whatever other music comes along in MIDI format. And the result is EMI's own personal musical style. A style that candidly reveals its debts to the masters, while being an unquestionably idiosyncratic integration of all this experience. EMI can now compose not just two-part inventions and art songs, but whole symphonies, and has composed over 1,000, when last I heard. They are good enough to fool experts, composers and professors of music, and I can personally attest to the fact that an EMI Puccini aria brought a lump to my throat. David Cope can no more claim to be the composer of EMI's symphonies and motets and art songs than Murray Campbell can claim to have beaten Kasparov in chess. To a Darwinian, this new element in the cascade of cranes is simply the latest in a long history, and we should recognize that the boundary between authors and their artifacts should be just as penetrable as all the other boundaries in the cascade. When Richard Dawkins, 1982, notes that the beaver's dam is as much a part of the beaver phenotype, its extended phenotype, as its teeth and its fur, he sets the stage for the further observation that the boundaries of a human author are exactly as amenable to extension. In fact, we have known this for centuries, and have carpentered various semi-stable conventions for dealing with the products of Rubens, of Rubens' studio, of Rubens' various students. Wherever there can be a helping hand, we can raise the question of just who is helping whom. What is creator, and what is creation? 50. Noise in the virtual hotel. Consider the difference between virtual worlds and real worlds. If you want to make a real hotel, you have to put a lot of time, energy, and materials into arranging matters so that the people in adjacent rooms can't overhear each other. When you go to make a virtual hotel, you get that insulation for free. In a virtual hotel, if you want the people in adjacent rooms to be able to overhear each other, you have to add that capacity. You have to add non-insulation. You also have to add shadows, aromas, vibration, dirt, footprints, and wear and tear. All these non-functional features come for free in the real, concrete world. The generic term for what must be added to virtual worlds to make them more realistic is collision detection. If you have ever tried to make a computer video game, you probably soon realize that putting shapes in motion on the screen is not enough. The shapes pass right through each other without any effect unless you build collision detection into the update loop, a cycle in your program that incessantly intervenes in whatever the program object is doing and asks, "Am I colliding with anything?" In his book, Le Tombeau de Marot, Doug Hofstetter, 1997, draws attention to the role of what he calls spontaneous intrusions into a creative process. In the real world, almost everything that happens leaves a wake, makes shadows, has an aroma, makes noise, and this provides a bounty of opportunities for spontaneous intrusions. It is also precisely what is in short supply in a virtual world. Indeed, one of the chief beauties of virtual worlds, from the point of view of computer modelers, is that quietness. Nothing happens except what you provide for, one way or another. This permits you to start with a clean slate and add features to your model one at a time, seeing what the minimal model is that will produce the sought-for effects. This absence of noise makes computer simulations of evolution extremely limited, since evolution by natural selection feeds on noise, turning fortuitously encountered noise into signal, junk into tools, bugs into features. An early computer simulation of evolution that is still one of the most impressive is Carl Sims's Evolved Virtual Creatures, 1994, which can be seen at carlsims.com/evolved-virtual-creatures. Sims started with random assemblies of virtual jointed blocks with virtual muscles to move the joints, and then let them evolve in their virtual world with its virtual physics. The program automatically selected the assemblages that moved the farthest on their trials for virtual mating, and then repeated the cycle with the resulting offspring. Better and better swimmers, walkers, and jumpers evolved, untouched by any intelligent designer's hand. The far-from-random designs that resulted demonstrated how efficiently virtual evolution could sorta discover good design principles and sorta reinvent a striking variety of features found in nature. It is a spectacular example of getting a lot from a relatively simple model. But it also shows the narrow limits of virtual world evolution. Sims designed the simple developmental system that takes whole genomes as inputs and yields novel organisms as outputs. But that process is all backstage, not part of the virtual world being simulated. As a result, an accidental bump or shock or collision with a bit of virtual debris cannot shorten or lengthen a genome, or change the rules of gene expression. All of that machinery is simply not in the virtual world with its virtual stuff, and hence is immutable. There is no way, for instance, for a Sims creature to evolve a new chromosome. Its whole genetic system is outside the model, not facing natural selection itself, but merely conveying genetic information by fiat between generations. For another example of this phenomenon, see Chapter 51. In a computer model of creativity, there should be junk lying around that your creative processes can bump into, noises that your creative processes can't help overhearing. The spontaneous intrusion of that little noise from the next room may tweak what those processes are doing in a way that is serendipitous, or in a way that is destructive, but either way, this opens up new possibilities. The exploitation of accidents is the key to creativity, whether what is being made is a new genome, a new behavior, or a new melody. Let me clarify what I'm not saying. The problem with Sims's evolved creatures is not that they are not made of carbon or that they contain no protein or hemoglobin. The problem is that they are virtual, and by being virtual, they live in a world many orders of magnitude simpler than the world of biological evolution. The same thing is true of Cope's EMI. Wonderful as it is, EMI is orders of magnitude simpler than the world of human musical composition. What's delightful about both cases is the discovery of just how much you can get from something so clean, so noise-free, so abstract. We can imagine improving Cope's EMI or Sims's work or any other such project in artificial life or artificial creativity by adding more and more and more junk, more and more opportunities for collisions into the world. This would provide more virtual stuff for their Sims to cope with. And you never can tell when serendipity will strike, if given an opportunity. But consider how counterintuitive such advice would appear. No matter what you're modeling, make sure that every phenomenon, every subroutine, everything that happens in that world broadcasts a variety of non-functional effects through the world, makes extraneous noises, leaves a wake, sheds dust, causes vibrations, and so forth. Why? What is all this noise for? It's not for anything. It's just there so that every other process has that noise as a potential source of signal, as something that it might turn, by the alchemy of the creative algorithm, into function, into art, into meaning. Every increment of design in the universe begins with a moment of serendipity, the undesigned intersection of two trajectories, yielding something that turns out, retrospectively, to be more than a mere collision. But to the extent that computer modelers follow this advice, they squander the efficiency that makes computers such great tools. So there's a sort of homeostasis here. We can see that, not for any mysterious reason, computer modeling of creativity confronts diminishing returns. In order to get closer and closer to the creativity of a human composer, the model has to become ever more concrete. It has to model more and more of the incidental collisions that impinge on an embodied composer. 51. Herb, Alice, and Hal, the baby. The late great evolutionary theorist, George Williams, insisted that it was a mistake to identify genes with DNA molecules. That would be approximately the same mistake as thinking that Hamlet is made out of ink. Of course, any actual copy of Shakespeare's play has to be made out of something. If not ink, then maybe letter-shaped patterns on a computer screen, or even strings of binary code burned into a CD. But the play is an abstract, informational thing that can hop from medium to medium. Genes, as recipes for making proteins, are also abstract, informational things according to this way of thinking, which has always struck me as the right way. But there have been those who disagree, who doubt the value of conceiving of genes in this way. For them, and in particular for philosopher of biology Peter Godfrey Smith, I constructed a little intuition pump. Herb and Alice want to have a baby, but here's how they do it. 1. They both have their genomes sequenced. They receive in the mail a data file consisting of their genomes, spelled out in two sequences of approximately 3 billion letters, A, C, G, T, and so on. 2. Then they write a little computer program that does the meiosis algorithm on both their genomes, randomly, creating virtual sperm and eggs, which are then randomly united in silico to create a new genome specification, which passes all the forensic tests for being the specification of the DNA of an offspring of Herb and Alice. So far, this is all done literally in terms of the symbols ACGT, a purely computational process of string rewriting. 3. This specification is then used to construct, codon by codon, an actual DNA implementation of the entire genome. A equals adenine, C equals cytosine, G equals guanine, and T equals thymine. Craig Venture's lab can now do this. 4. This genome is then implanted in the nucleus of a human egg. Does it matter whose egg this is, since its own DNA will be removed before nucleus implantation? And becomes a test tube baby in one of the usual ways. Is the resulting infant, Hal, the child of Herb and Alice? It seems to me to be quite obvious that Hal is indeed their biological offspring, since it avails itself of all the genetic information they would contribute if Hal were conceived in the normal way. This intuition pump highlights the importance of what matters in reproduction: information, and the causal transmission of information. In this case, in the form of ASCII code for A, C, G, and T, not in the form of molecules. The causal link might, for instance, pass through telecommunication satellites instead of taking the more direct biochemical routes. Drawn with revisions from personal correspondence, April 26, 2010. Godfrey Smith agreed with me that Hal is the offspring of Herb and Alice, but he had some reservations about my way of putting it, which can be read unabridged in Dennett 2010, Godfrey Smith 2011. In the same spirit of constructive criticism, I acknowledged that there is a biologically important difference between the process Herb and Alice use to procreate and the way we normally do. What if everybody did it Herb and Alice's way? Since the genetic information from Herb does not ride in its usual vehicle, a sperm cell, on its route to the egg, sperm motility would no longer be under selection pressure, and would, other things being equal, decline over the generations. Use it or lose it. Still, I maintain, and think this intuition pump illustrates clearly, that the molecular structure that stays roughly constant over the generations is preserved because it embodies the information that it does. If there were alternate structures that preserved the information, evolution would continue unimpeded. This claim can be further examined in yet another intuition pump. Imagine that on another planet, odd-numbered generations used the DNA rungs A, C, G, and T, and even-numbered generations used a different double helix, call it XNA, with rungs made of P, Q, R, and S, some other molecules. We can suppose that the offspring's XNA molecules were made from DNA templates from their parents by a mechanism rather like messenger RNA, but translating between the two different biochemical languages. These messages would be translated back by another messenger mechanism in the next generation, and so forth. You'd have to find a mate whose genes were written in the same language if you wanted offspring, but those offspring would have genomes written in the other language. Oedipal unions would be infertile, which is probably just as well. But there might be many Romeo and Juliet-style tragedies in which lovers could not procreate since they came from opposite communities. They could always settle for a barren sex life and adopt babies of either type, or even play egg donor and sperm donor and raise half-siblings galore. In such a world, aside from these complications, evolution would continue as always, transmitting genetic information about valuable adaptations and heritable diseases, etc., through the generations in alternative coding systems that could be as structurally different as you please. Same genes, different molecules. Each gene would have two forms, as different as cat and chat, house and maison. Note the parallel with the case of the two black boxes. What the two syntactically structurally different vehicles in both cases have in common is the same information, the same semantics. 52. Memes. I haven't mentioned memes yet, which may make some readers wonder if I have abandoned them. Not at all. The concept of memes is one of my favorite thinking tools, and I have a lot to say about it. Too much to put in this book. I have already said a great deal about memes elsewhere. Dennett, 1990, 1991A, 1995A, to cite a few examples. For various reasons, many people have a visceral dislike of the concept, so they tend to fall for the many criticisms that have been raised. I have decided that I should try one more time to make the case for memes and deal with all the critics, both the serious critics and the white-knuckled meme haters, but that will take a small book of its own. In the meantime, those who want to know more about memes should take a look at my essay on them, The New Replicators, 2002, also in Dennett 2006A. But here, as a preview, is a brief introduction to the serious concept of memes, in contrast to its over-popular loose usage by internet denizens. As Dawkins, 1976, pointed out, when he introduced the concept of the meme as a cultural item that gets itself copied, the fundamental principle of biology is that all life evolves by the differential survival of replicating entities. The gene, the DNA molecule, happens to be the replicating entity which prevails on our own planet. There may be others. If there are, provided certain other conditions are met, they will almost inevitably tend to become the basis for an evolutionary process. But do we have to go to distant worlds to find other kinds of replication and other consequent kinds of evolution? I think that a new kind of replicator has recently emerged on this very planet. It is staring us in the face. It is still in its infancy, still drifting clumsily about in its primeval soup, but already it is achieving evolutionary change at a rate which leaves the old gene panting far behind. Page 206. Two main insights that flow from this thinking tool dramatically alter the landscape of our imaginations when we think about human culture and creativity. First, memes shatter the otherwise seductive idea that there are only two routes to good design. It's either genes or genius. For most thinkers, until memes open their eyes, if something in human life exhibits the telltale signs of adaptation of means to ends or functional efficiency, it must be either a product of genetic natural selection or a product of deliberate, comprehending, intending human thinking, intelligent design. Orgel's second law, evolution is cleverer than you are, might seem to enshrine the two options. But in fact, there is a third possibility, and it is everywhere instanced. Non-genetic cultural selection, accomplished by the same process of mindless natural selection that gives us the genes. A vivid example is provided by an observation about Polynesian canoes more than a century old. Every boat is copied from another boat. It is the sea herself who fashions the boats, choosing those which function and destroying the others. Alain, 1908. This is natural selection plain as day. The islanders have a simple rule. If it returns from the sea intact, copy it. They may have considerable comprehension of the principles of naval architecture that retrospectively endorse their favorite designs, but it is strictly unnecessary. Evolution takes care of the quality control. The same is true of grammatical rules, words, religious practices, and many other bedrock features of human culture. Nobody designed them, and they're not in our genes, but they are nevertheless quite excellently designed. The second insight is that the price we pay for having this extra information highway, this bounteous medium of design and transmission that no other species enjoys, is that memes have their own fitness, just like all the other symbionts that thrive in our company, and their fitness is to some degree independent of our own fitness. Blindness to this idea is endemic, and is particularly evident when people